Welcome to the Love Irish Food Green Ireland podcast series, episode 10, an essential listen to anyone in the food industry. I'm your host, Conal O'Moran. Love Irish Food is dedicated to sustainable, local Irish food and drinks brands that supports the many, many thousands of local jobs and communities that depend on our Irish food industry. Visit loveirishfood.ie for a full list of your local brands. In this series, we're looking at topics affecting the Irish food industry, ranging from the shop local movement, funding, selling online, digital marketing, and so much more. Joining me today is a man who titles himself the Food Accountant, and with good reason. Aidan O'Byrne, founder of OBK Accountants, spent more than 9 years as Group Finance Director of Food Brands Bachelors. He was then almost 2 years with Valio Foods, and he has been a director of Love Irish Food for 13 years since he co-founded the organization. Let's just say that Aidan knows his onions. Aidan, you're very welcome to the podcast, where on this episode 10, we, or maybe you, are going to give our company accounts a health check.
Thank you very much, Conal. Glad to be here.
You know your business.
Yes, I suppose I have. I have been in the business a long time, first in Bachelors and then as CFO of Valio. So now that I have the accountancy practice, I suppose it gives us a very unique insight in being able to give advice on food accounting, both having been the man, the man in the factory, and now obviously as a practitioner.
I love a good pun. You were a bean counter.
I was a bean counter. I used to sign my Christmas cards from the bean counter.
I've only just thought of that now. Sorry. It's obviously
not
very
the first
old.
Time.
Okay. Listen, let us get down to business and start talking on a 101. This is a 101 for anybody in the food business, because the food business, you will tell me, is different to other kinds of business.
Food and food accounting is really a law unto itself. It's a fast-moving, FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods. Food finance, you really have to be on top of your numbers. It is absolutely crucial. I've had startup people coming into me and said, Aidan, do you know something? I have this great product, it's lovely food, tastes great. I'm not very good with numbers. And unfortunately, the first thing I have to say is, well, you're going to have to learn. Because without being on top of your numbers, really, without saying the old joke about FMCG, how do you make a million in FMCG? You start with two. It really is crucial that you stay absolutely on top of your numbers and absolutely up to date. And certainly the up to date element would be something now as we are into 2022. It's the first time in many years that we have food inflation. For a lot of the last decade, there wasn't really an awful lot of inflation in the market. Food prices were relatively stable, both input prices and in the shops. Now we're seeing the situation with energy prices going up, labour prices are going up, input prices are going up. Now people more than ever have to be on top of their finances.
Now, you know a lot of companies, startups and large, in the food industry. I've come across quite a few myself over the years. One thing I know is those in the business frequently love the making, not necessarily the counting. Counting is boring, but making and selling is fun.
Absolutely. And one of the most critical parts is to make sure that the two bits of your business, your finance side and your commercial side, actually wear the same jersey. They actually speak to each other. Because, say, if you take your standard your standard product, I'm going to go back to my beans. It's easier for me to start my tins of beans. So we'll use the beans analogy right through it. Our can of beans was, you know, you'd have your can, your beans, your bean, your flavour, your tomato, your label, your outer or packaging, your energy and your labour. And that's what made your can of beans. It's essential that the finance team keep the sales and commercial team up to date with if those prices are changing. The sales guys there out on the road thinking, oh God, Grant, you know, I'm selling it for £5, cost me £3, happy days, move on. If the price has changed, the commercial team need to know because they're going off doing their deals. If the margin is falling at the moment in an inflationary environment, if people don't keep on top of their numbers, their margins are going to fall. And that's where we really have to do. It's boring. It's a horrible, boring exercise where we go through the bill of materials. Your bill of materials, which is a list of your ingredients, a list of your packaging that goes in to make your product, and go through and sign them off as being the current prices. A thing that my father, quite old these days, but he used to always say to me, Aidan, what gets measured gets managed. So if you've got your bill of materials, make your list of what it is. Everyone's done it. Every food company has a bill of materials because that's what they have to produce every day. They go in, their factory produces, you know, X amount goes into each can or each pot or whatever. So all you're doing is putting financial numbers on that and up-to-date financial numbers.
But you are using terms like the financial team, the sales team, the commercial team. I'm thinking of a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 person organization. They don't have teams. They're all in it together. They are the team.
True, but they have to put their have the two hats on simultaneously. The chief executive often thinks as a salesperson. He might have a bookkeeper or a junior finance person. It's crucial. It's unlikely that he's doing it all, that he, she are doing it all themselves. But they need to keep that relationship with whoever is keeping the books to make sure that their current numbers, that the current information that they have is up to date. Otherwise, you'll end up with a situation where you're going off and making commercial deals and you haven't got up to date information. We have a situation at the moment now, energy prices are going up. So, for instance, if you're running a factory that's using a lot of energy, trust me, the unit price of energy within your product is significantly increasing. Same way at labour. You might have the same people on the floor and you think, no, my labour rates isn't going up. You might think, sure, I'm not paying the guys any more wages. But what happens? Guys come down in COVID, you still have to fill the order. The guys are coming in doing overtime. So your total number mightn't have changed, but your unit price now has because you're paying the guys time and a half, double time, whatever. It's important. And you might have the best accounting systems in the world. But trust me, while they might update your raw material prices, they might update your packaging, they might update your ingredients, no computer system updates automatically labor and energy absorption.
And how often, seriously, do you have to do this little health check?
At an absolute minimum. At an absolute minimum, I would do it every 3 months. There's no point saying, oh, do it every week. Nah, we won't. It doesn't matter. Us accountants, why? You must have nothing better to be doing with your time than doing bill of materials. It would be great to do it every 3 months. And what I encourage clients to do is what I call the power of the signature. Do it, print out your bill of materials, put it on a spreadsheet, print it out and put your lovely signature in pen at the bottom to say, I have checked that. And now, as of January 2022, the cost price of our products is X. And then, at least during that period, you can then base your commercial output decisions on that. It's absolutely essential that people keep this up to date because of the inflationary environment that we find ourselves in now.
Budgets become forecasts.
Budgets always be a budget is a budget only for a day.
And then how does it turn into a forecast?
Well, ultimately, your forecast ends up, so at the end of month one, you've done your actual. So you've done your budget. You haven't stuck it on the shelf. You haven't stuck it in the filing cabinet. You're actually going to use it. Happy days. I have my budget. I've also set up the budget in the way I want to manage the business. If you want to manage the business by every different type of sales, make sure your accounting system reports those every different type of sales. There are some packages where you'll have to set up the system accordingly. So at the end of month one, you've an actual. So grand. So your forecast is now effectively your actual for month one, and providing none of your assumptions have changed, then your budget for months 2 through to 12. And then as every month goes, you replace the actual with the budget, and then you change your forecast. Just say things have happened. You've got a new customer. Your prices have gone up. You spend a little bit of time updating so to change your forecast for the year. Remember, there's two different types of budgets, two main different types of forecasts. One is a profit and loss forecast and the other is a cash flow forecast. And they are both extremely different. And
do explain.
Your profit and loss is effectively your sales, less your cost of sales, less your overheads, including things like depreciation and stuff like, which is a non-cash cost because the cash has taken place when you bought the asset. Your cash flow forecast is when the money comes in and when the money goes out. You might sell something in January, so it's gone into your profit and loss account in January, you might not get paid for it until March. It won't come into your cash flow until March. And it's essential. No company has ever gone out of business purely for a lack of profit. Lots of businesses go out of business for lack of cash. So I've seen businesses that on the on the face of it, their profit and loss accounts don't look too bad. They might be break even or maybe a small loss. And they're in dire trouble because they've basically run out of cash because they haven't managed their cash properly.
And the one that really bugs me is VAT. Because I look at numbers and I choose to maybe or forget to, but I look at the big number and say, God, that's great. That's coming to the bank. And I forget about the 23%.
Well, I've always got a little bit of advice for startups and small businesses. Small businesses have a terrible habit of using the revenue commissioners as a source of finance. Now, while we all might think that's a great idea, trust me, in the long term, it's not.
And the revenue commissioners don't seem to like it either.
No, they don't, surprisingly enough. And what I would often, particularly for what I call the newbies to the business, people who've never run a business before, people who are not used to handling amounts of cash, I don't mean physical cash, but money, I'll always say to them, if you're selling a product that has VAT on it, so therefore, as you said, it might be 23%, set up a separate bank account. Put a VAT element into that bank account every week. Put that bank account behind the glass and throw away the key until the 19th of the month, the third month. So your January and February, usually you're paying your VAT on the 19th of March. And therefore, lo and behold, there is your cash is sitting there waiting to be paid over to our friends, the revenue commissioners. Because often there's nothing worse than I get phone calls from clients. Aidan, can we have a chat? Don't have much cash. I bought a machine. And I'm going, great. How did you? Well, I bought it out of the current account. And now I have no money and I owe the VAT man and I owe the PAYE. And I'm there going, well, okay. Possibly we shouldn't have bought the machine out of the current account. We should have used the alternative sources of finance. We should have taken out a bank loan, possibly. We should have maybe looked to get a grant for it, et cetera, et cetera. We may have even, for sold or for new companies whose owner managed, one thing that I always, what's wrong with taking in an investor, getting cash in? You own 100%. People love, I have 100% of the business. I own 100%. It's great. Why not take in some new equity? Give 10% of your business. Get them to pay for it.
I'll give you two reasons. One is kind of control, because entrepreneurs love that control thing. And the second thing is value and, you know, that who values it. That becomes another obstacle, doesn't it?
No, at the end of the day, from a legal and control perspective, once you maintain over 75% of the shares, you're effectively in control.
And explain that 75%, because this is very important.
Well, there's a lot of legislative items about who has control. Like, obviously, if you've got more than 50%, you can vote. But there are certain things maybe in the constitution of the company which might need 2/3 or might need 75%. I've rarely seen anything that requires unanimity in voting to get something through. But obviously, if you've got you can't, your minority interest who are the people who own the small amount of share capital, you must be true and correct for them.
You cannot oppress them.
That's the word I was trying to remember. Oppression of the minority interest.
I always love that one, yeah.
You can't oppress your minority interest. But often there's a case of, you know, somebody might say, I'd love to invest in your business. And, oh, no, I don't want to. I don't want to give any of my share capital away. At the end of the day, 90% of a large number is better than 100% of nothing.
And to find those investors, that's not easy either, because you have to have, like, somebody compatible, if you like.
Having a compatible investor is crucial. It's also having a compatible business partner to make sure that culturally you're the same. Often businesses are, you know, business change hands and the cultures change. You know, you might go from a business that was a family business. Then there will be a business like, say, our original bachelor business was very much, although it was owned by in the 60s, right up to when we bought it in 2002, it was owned by UK multinationals. It was still almost like a family business. Everyone knew everyone else. But then as things change, maybe relationships change, company cultures change. So if you're going to take somebody in as an investor, make sure that they understand the culture that the business is going to be run under. And if you're the dominant shareholder, it's probably going to be run under your culture. You know, and make sure that they understand what your culture is.
And I would imagine people listening to this podcast are thinking, yeah, but where will I find this benign, gorgeous, wealthy investor?
There used to be. I haven't seen it in a while. There used to be organisations like HBAN and stuff like that.
They're still there.
HBAN are still there. Who try to marry, for want of a better word, people with an interest in investing with companies. But at the end of the day, the best people to talk to for investors would be your accountants or your solicitors or your banks. We would often get connected. Companies would often contact us and say, listen, I'm thinking of selling. Do you know anybody who you know? And we'd go and think, well, you know something, I think Mary or Johnny might be interested in buying and put two and two together. Or you might know somebody who has a factory with excess capacity and you might think, God, I think there might be a business there. So always use your networks.
So let me switch another direction completely. Alternative suppliers. When the business is trundling along nicely, don't forget to get alternative suppliers.
Absolutely. We all know COVID has been, a wake-up call for a lot of us.
And Brexit.
We were continuing along merrily. We had our suppliers and all of a sudden, either first of all with Brexit and then with COVID, we may not have been able to get the product that we wanted. It is essential. If you're sitting there on a Monday morning looking to manufacture your product, you have to have all the raw and packaging materials there. If for some reason or another your existing supplier can't provide, you must get yourself an alternative supplier. And I spoke earlier about having your bill of materials. Make sure you have a bill of materials for your alternative supplier. They may not be the same.
But you'd only switch really if it's beneficial.
Yeah, but also you can end up switching because that would be the normal case, but you might end up changing because you want to reduce currency risk. You might have a supplier in the UK. You might want to go into Euroland, whether it's Ireland or in mainland Europe.
Are you seeing much of that?
I'm seeing a bit of movement out of the UK, yes. I'm seeing people who previously would have bought product from UK suppliers moving to Euro-based and ideally Irish-based suppliers.
You are listening to the Love Irish Food podcast. For more information, visit www.loveirishfood.ie.
If you can avoid the euro sterling issue, are people finding suppliers, be they in Ireland or be they across mainland Europe, are they finding those suppliers to be better value or is it?
I don't know. There's certainly in the UK at the moment, there is an element of flux in the UK they're getting used to having of being sort of outside the tent at this stage. Certainly getting supplies from some UK suppliers I found difficult. A lot of people sorted that out before the Brexit. They bought in fairly large quantities, so therefore you had the working capital effect of your cash flow of having a lot of stock.
And that was fine for a while.
It does run down. It does. And that people have probably gone through their Brexit stock. But another thing that we need to consider as you're growing is you might have got your preferred supplier. There might be a guy who say you're manufacturing pesto and there's a guy has supplied you with basil. He's a little farmer and he supplied you with basil when you were little. And now you're growing. Always make sure that your suppliers can grow with you. And if they can't, then you're also going to have to get yourself that alternative supplier. If you love a local supplier, but they can only do two tons a year and you now need 5 tons, unfortunately, you're probably going to have to think, well, initially, some entrepreneurs will be nice. They'll say, well, I'll take my 2 tons off you and I'll get 3 tons elsewhere. Unfortunately, the most likelihood is you'll end up getting the 5 tons elsewhere.
A more direct route, easier route,
whatever,
and a simpler ordering, etc.
You may get it. And you may get it at a cheaper price. Always remember that you should always look for cheaper price as you go. When we bought Aaron Foods in 2007, we bought the Aaron Foods brand. We didn't buy their factory and their operations that were down in Thurles at the time. We just bought the brand. So we had to now set up an Aaron Foods factory within Cabra. And so
why did you choose Cabra?
Well, Cabra was our own factory in Batchers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we had to put it into our own onto our own factory. So we had a brilliant operations director, Conor Costello. And Conor was mandated to go across Europe and find the machinery to build an Aaron Foods factory on a small footprint in Cabra. Successfully did that. But we were new to that industry. So therefore, when we were buying our first set of dried goods, we were charged, X, Y, and Z. Probably a lot more than Aaron would have been paying originally. Then as we grew, obviously, we're able to demand cheaper prices. So always remember, as it never, you know, you always have to ask. So always, as you're growing, you know, make sure that you're getting the best deal off your suppliers. And certainly if you're doing something where you were doing, say, 10,000 pots when you started your relationship, and now you're doing 100,000 pots and they're still charging you the same price, you know.
You've got to have the chat.
You have to have the chat. It's never, don't be afraid of the chat. You know, a lot of people, particularly those, if it's a small business, who might be on the, who got into food for love. God, it's...
How many people in your experience do that? I can imagine lots.
Lots. Most of the really startups come in and they'll come in to me and they're there in the first full of joy of, they might be making, say, cakes because everyone said they make great cakes. So now they decided to do it as a living. And, you know, and then we sit down and we have, it's probably not particularly politically correct, I used to call it the come to Jesus session, where we go through your business model and find out, can you make money? You know, is it possible? You know,
and where were the big problem areas that always appeared?
Oh, it's scale. Always scale. The food industry, as everyone who's listening to this podcast knows, the food industry has a certain amount of fixed cost that nobody knows about. Compliance, health and safety, all these things that to have a food factory you have to have.
And as a rule of thumb, putting a finger in the air, around figures, how much percentage-wise might that incur?
It's not so much the percentage-wise that it incur, it's more the amount of sales that you have to generate. I would argue, if somebody came in to me and said, well, do you know something? I'm going to do €300,000 sales in my first year. I will really think, will struggle to see how they will convert €300,000 worth of sales into a viable business. You know,
are you suggesting that you have to be bigger than that?
Oh yes, like it's
so. As again, back to my rule, my thumbs. Where would you think that people should be aiming for a viable business?
Certainly, I would see, by viability, I mean the ability to run, pay your bills on time, have staff, pay staff, and pay yourself. You know, there's an awful lot of, you know, people get into the food industry for love, but that love dissipates fairly quickly if you're doing it for free. So I always say to somebody, when we're working out their business model, we work out how much do they value their time. And never, please never come in and say, oh, well, I'm just, you know, I won't pay myself. God, well, that'll wear fairly thin fairly quickly. Like, you know?
Well, I presume that there are bills at the other end, would be the household bills or whatever.
No, exactly. Yeah. So therefore, people often say, because at the start, you probably can't pay yourself, you know, because there's other, you know, you're down the chain. But you've got to get yourself into the chain of payments as quickly as possible. And I will always try and work out to somebody, how can we get that model to a stage where they can make, they as in the owner, can make a valuable and a decent wage? Because that's really where, you know, that's how it grows, you know, how your business grows, because you still keep the enthusiasm. Your enthusiasm will wane when you're doing it when you're into year four and you still haven't. And your savings are gone, and you know, maybe your other half, you're relying on your other half for all the salary, and maybe that's getting a bit tetchy now as well, because your little project is now costing us a lot of money. You know?
300,000 is not viable. What is?
I always think half a million, I think, is a good, if you're manufacturing something, so half a million of sales, net sales, after, you know, which, you know, your sales, not the Vatman sales, your sales, and then you strip that back.
So you've just cost me another whatever it is.
No, I'm saying real sales. So that's gross of six. So if it was half a million, that would be over 600,000 in outgoing sales.
The fellas listening to this and they've just said, we'll never make 600,000 euro in sales.
I think if you're looking to run a food business of any scale, I really do think you need to set that sort of as your minimum, sort of half million as your minimum target. And like even, you know, I was the finance lead on the Super Values Food Academy program when they had the advanced program. And I was and that's really where, you know, we started getting to those which were still operating at sort of the 250, 300, you know, they were really having difficulties. Those which were in the 500 to a million were certainly beginning to see that there was a, you know, there was a real business there. And obviously those over the million, you were making sure that they were doing things efficiently, because actually they were in the, you know, as we used to describe, in danger of making a profit. you know, and obviously as it scales up beyond that.
So consolidation, if you are cake manufacturer or whatever, where and how do you start looking at other cake manufacturers to say, to get to my 600,000 sales, I've got to buy somebody else?
Buying another business, yes, unfortunately, it costs money. And so often, you know, like you're not going to go down to your local guy and say, oh, you know something, I'll take you out and I'll buy you out and you know, we'll do some sort of a deal. But those businesses who start, and they may have a certain amount of capital, they may find that buying a little bit of turnover is in fact one of the better ways to start. I had a project cross my desk recently where there was a relatively small business in the west of Ireland was for sale. And on its own, I wasn't, you know, it wouldn't have really been too exciting. But we had another client who were in that business who were, you know, who were moving, you know, who had a certain amount of turnover, mainly on the eastern seaboard. And we were able to say, do you know something? If you merge, you know, if we get those two businesses and put them together, there is actually a reasonable business. Now, in that case, what we did was a certain amount of payment was made up front, and then a certain amount of was deferred effectively as an earnout to make sure that our friends on the Western Seaboard behaved properly and didn't go off and set up a business in competition 6 months later.
And to fund that, where would be a good place to go?
Obviously, there's a certain amount of bank funding. Banks will fund good deals.
Will they? Your experience.
They will fund good deals. Paperwork has to be good. And that's where, you know, without, you know, don't want to be doing too much plugging, but that's where your advisor comes into place. Where, you know, you have to have a business plan, you have to have forecasts. You know, a lot of people need someone to provide the glue to put all that together. They know their business inside out, but can they capture it in 10 pages? Possibly not. And that's where you need the glue. Bank finance, equity finance. There's a lot of alternative sources of, there's a lot of alternative sources now. There's funds that are interested in investing.
Even in small units, small companies.
A lot of the funds that are being set up, a lot of the, who want to get into a certain space, whether it's food or whether it's green energy, green or whatever it is, they may have a threshold, but you don't know what that threshold is unless you ask, you know? And certainly if it's something that's, you know, some of the food side, they might want to get in early into a cycle. For instance, like health and wellness, food in relation to health and wellness. I'm not specifically talking about vegetarian or vegan or anything like that. I'm talking about health and wellness. That has become very much popular over the last few years. And certainly people were very interested in getting into that ahead of the curve maybe a couple of years
ago. But they don't really want Mary and Mike, a two-person operation, surely.
Not the ventures. I'm talking about the slightly bigger ones.
Okay.
You know, Mary and Mike, you're talking about getting a balance between their own funds, Leo funds. Always make sure that you have captured...
Most important, the Leos.
Yes, the Leos, all of them, Varadkar and the 32 and the 26 around the country. The Leos are... very important to make sure you understand what their schedule of offering that they can. I was involved in a startup a few years ago. We set up a tortilla plant in Tipperary, Blanco Nino.
I know them well.
Well, I was a director of Blanco Nino.
Fabulous company.
Yeah, and how we started off, Phil, the owner, or the founder, is a Dubliner. But the Tipperary Leo were willing to fund... you know, the start.
And had he kind of, I know Phil, and so therefore I don't think I've ever asked him this question. Did he try the Dublin Leos?
Well, we would have not qualified.
Okay.
Like a lot of...
So therefore, there's a top tip, is go knock on a couple of doors.
Well, certainly in the tip case, we had a situation where we found a site down there. It was an old bakery. We found a brilliant retired production manager, Jerry Raftery, who was... it was local, and so that factory got set up in Clonmel, run down there, and has where it's now in, I think it's its seventh year. But that's an example of something where you have to think sort of laterally, rather than say, well, I have to do it here now in my local area.
So that's your Leo. Now back to the banks, because of course the natural default position of everybody to say, they're not interested.
Banks will fund good projects.
How do you measure a good project, and how big is a good project, or how small?
I suppose if you're putting a banking hat on, you want to see certain things attached to it. They tend to be more favourably disposed towards a project where you had the factory, you owned the factory, you owned machinery, so they can hang their hook on a bit of collateral.
Ah, but now there you go. What about the family home and all the rest? Because
no,
that is
like,
always.
No, like never, like, you know, never put, never, from a business perspective, and I think this applies to all businesses, never put anything at risk that you're not willing to risk. So, like, I would always have argued aggressively against personal guarantees. Myself and my colleagues and the two venture partners that we had, when we bought Bachelors in 2002, and we borrowed a lot of money off the now defunct Anglo-Irish Bank, we did it with no PGs. That was our red line. We said we were, you know, in that case, it was a case of we were borrowing a significant sum of money and our factory was on a rather large tract of land. And we argued that the land was the security, you know.
Could make a very nice building site.
Correct. Okay. So therefore that was a security. So there was no point, there was absolutely no need to be looking for personal guarantees.
Okay. But that's now at the larger end, back down to the smaller end, the more realistic end. Funding again. It's always going to be a problem, isn't it?
It is, but it's a question of you have to end up with your full menu. So you have your own funds. The FF&F round, friends, family, and fools, like your people who they're not family, but they're people who like to see you succeed. You've got the banks for which the banks, they're what we call their non-risk finance. So, for instance, the banks, I always tell clients to go and if they've got a, particularly if they've blue chip customers, to go and see if they can get invoice discounting finance. You know, invoice discounting, for those who don't use it, is where the bank takes effectively your sales ledger. You send out the invoices on this week and they pay you, say, 75% of the money next week. You know, there's a bit of an administrative burden, so it's probably not great for the mom and pop, but it's certainly viable for the ones who have slightly moved on a little. I'm not talking about the big guys.
And there are new people into that market in Ireland, aren't there?
Not necessarily bank. There are people who they're you know, the non-bank. I spoke at a farm in the days before COVID when we were able to have conferences in person. I spoke at a Farmers Journal conference about the alternative sources of finance and funds and the various non-bank finances. A lot of people out there, who've linked finance. You know, people like Linked Finance, who would have been a good example at the time, who provided loan and in some cases sourced equity capital for outside of the banking structure. So look around, there's a hell of a lot more available now than there used to be. And I know our number of pillar banks are pretty low now, but there is other sources of finance available.
And hopefully more will come into the market. Right, your top three, everybody loves a top three or a top five. Give us your top three tips for a food industry in 2022 for staying in business using all that we've just been talking about.
Have a budget and a forecast that you stick to.
I'm just going to pick you up on that one. When a person is in love with his or her business, budgets and forecasts can be airy-fairy.
Yes, and when I spoke earlier about what we used to call the come to Jesus session, it was the most common disease that people had was that glorious disease called Excelitis, who would say that, you know, well, I go to sell X and then my profits aren't they great? And then my question was always, we'd build your sales from zero. So for instance, if you are John and Mary and you're starting off and your first type of business might be at farmers markets. So you're doing 10 farmers markets a week. So and then you might get a local listing with Supervalue or with Dunn Stores or whatever. You build up your sales base from the number of stores or the number of markets and the number of days. And so you have to build your model up on reality.
Okay. That's the first hurdle.
First hurdle. Build it up on reality. So, and then people would say to me, well, how much, you know, I'm going to sell a case of product every day in every shop. And we'd say, well, I'm sorry. You know, often people would use a rule of thumb that if you're selling a product in a shop, you're probably going to sell no more than one or two units of product per day.
I've heard that before. And when I heard it first, I went, really? That is a bit of an eye-opener, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. So like, I would, you know, I certainly don't like seeing people use figure north of two.
Okay.
Like it's, it might be...
And that's two units, two not, unit, two pallets
or two cases. Two. Yeah. Because obviously if you have a situation where you're in a lot of stores, it still might add up.
Yeah.
But it means that you do... If you're building up a sales figure of a million and you're selling it at two, and you're on the sale you're selling at two, so that's half a million units you have to find.
You will be running very fast.
Yes.
Now... Give me two more. That was one lovely one. Two more big ideas that must-dos.
In 2022, you've got to sign off that bill of materials. You've
okay.
got to sign it off. It's got to be up to date. You've got to sign it off.
All right, that's agreed.
You've got to, absolutely.
And you've got to sign it off every quarter, you say?
I would say every quarter in the current inflationary environment. If we get to a situation where inflation isn't as prevalent, you might get away with a bit. But really, it certainly should be done at least every quarter. And the third one, for the small emerging businesses, is to go on to your Leo websites and go through the list of grants or projects or schemes that Leos have available and evaluate your business against them. Don't just look at them and go, oh no, none of those apply. Literally print it out and go through. There might have 40 schemes. Go through and say, why you qualify or why you don't.
And another thing that I've learned there is if you live, say, in South Dublin, you do not have to go to your South Dublin Leo. You can go to the Laois or to the Clare.
You can, providing you do your operation there, obviously.
Well, they also have specialist knowledge
yes.
as well. Wicklow, for example, the Leo there, very big on food, isn't that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And they will, it's a state organisation, they're there to help.
There is a bit of competition within the Leos as well.
Oh, yes, there is, yes.
You know, they like to see them, they like to see their sponsored businesses go well. But certainly if you're not absolutely hung up on where you're going to, particularly if your project is what I call a science project at this stage, you're not started, then you need to look at, is it better doing it in a rural environment where you may be able to get a lot more assistance, but then you have to marry that with the availability of labour and stuff like that. They're a balancing act that you have to really, really do.
Like business. All human life is there.
All human life is there. That's why it's FMCG. It's fast moving.
Aidan. That is Aidan O'Byrne, founder of OBK Accountants and co-founder of Love Irish Food. So well done for co-founding a brilliant organisation. And anybody who wants to get in contact with him, I'm sure you'll take a phone call at OBK Accountants.
Aidan@obk.ie, and we will absolutely take any mails, and as they always say, the first mail is free.
So thank you so much for listening to this. This is episode 10 of this, the Love Irish Food podcast series. As the title suggests, there are 9 other podcasts waiting for you to listen back to, all involving experts just like Aidan within the Irish food industry, all well worth a listen. So do listen back. So from me, Conal O'Moran, thanks for listening.
The Love Irish Food Podcast. For more information, visit www.loveirishfood.ie.